It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Jordan executes two militants after a captured pilot is murdered in Syria. Jordan has executed two militants in response to the Islamic State group's killing of one of its pilots. One of those executed Wednesday in Jordan was an Iraqi woman on death row for her role in a 2005 suicide bombing. The IS group demanded her release as part of a possible prisoner exchange. The executions followed a video that emerged online Tuesday appearing to show the militant group burning a Jordanian pilot alive while he was locked in a cage. Jordan's King Abdullah in Washington Tuesday vowed a strong response. President Obama spoke about the video before the meeting with the Jordanian monarch.
Should, in fact, this video be authentic, it's just one more indication of the viciousness and barbarity of this organization. And I think we'll redouble the vigilance and determination on the part of a global coalition to make sure that they are degraded and ultimately defeated.
The Jordanian pilot was captured when his jet crashed in Syria in December. The U.S. carried out another drone strike in Somalia against a senior leader from the militant group al-Shabaab. A Pentagon spokesman, Rear Admiral John Kirby, said Saturday's strike occurred south of Mogadishu, targeting Yusuf Deek, the group's chief of external operations.
I'm not in a position now to confirm the results of the strike. But if successful, if he no longer breathes, then this is another significant blow.
The U.S. has been targeting the al-Shabaab leadership in a series of strikes over the past few months. In December, the Pentagon confirmed the killing of intelligence chief Talil Abdishakur. This is VOA News. A commercial airplane crashed into a river outside Taiwan's capital early Wednesday, reportedly killing at least 8 people. 58 were on board the TransAsia Airways ATR-72, which crashed into a river shortly after takeoff. It's the second crash of the type of airplane in Taiwan in as many years. Hundreds of Chadian ground troops entered northeast Nigeria Tuesday as part of a growing regional offensive against the Boko Haram insurgency. A Nigerian government spokesman told VOA Chad's operating under bilateral protocol that allows them to pursue terrorists into Nigerian territory. In Washington Tuesday, the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General Vincent Stewart, told U.S. lawmakers Boko Haram presents a potential regional threat in part because of poor governance.
Ungoverned spaces, weak central government, weak security forces, extreme poverty. Those create opportunities that are exploited by these extreme ideology. So there are a number of places across the continent. And however, having said that, the African Union is starting to push back, and you're starting to see call for forces from moderate states on the continent to fight against those extreme ideologies.
General Stewart cited the lack of leadership and commitment in the Nigerian military and the improper equipping of troops that presents the country with challenges in confronting Boko Haram. Fighting between Ukraine's military and Russian-backed separatists killed at least 8 civilians in eastern Ukraine. Kiev and rebel officials say at least 22 were wounded in shelling late Monday and Tuesday. The fighting has raged in the self-declared separatist regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. Ravina Shamdasani of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is alarmed at the civilian casualties.
Bus stops and public transport, marketplaces, schools and kindergartens, hospitals and residential areas have become battlegrounds in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions of Ukraine, in clear breach of international humanitarian law. The death toll now exceeds 5,358 people, and another 12,235 have been wounded since mid-April last year.
The United States is considering whether to send lethal assistance to Ukraine's government in its fight against separatists. A UN inquiry into possible war crimes last year in Gaza will proceed despite the resignation of its chairman and protests from Israel. Mary McGowan Davis, a member of the Independent Commission, will replace former chief William Shabbas, who submitted his resignation Monday after an Israeli complaint that accused him of bias because of consultant work he did with the Palestine Liberation Organization. Britain could become the first country to allow creation of babies with DNA from 3 people. The House of Commons Tuesday voted to approve the controversial type of in vitro fertilization that could prevent mothers from passing inherited health problems. Critics see it as a step toward creation of designer babies. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Burundian opposition leader calls on President Pierre Nkurunziza not to seek a third term in violation of the Constitution.
Personally, I don't appreciate the fact that he's intended to run for a third term, because this should mean a violation of the Constitution and the peace agreement signed in Arusha in 2000.
Agathon Rwasa is the leader of the former Burundi Rebel National Liberation Front. A new diaspora policy causes mixed feelings among Kenyans abroad. South Africa says it will not deport Zimbabweans who did not reapply for special dispensation permits. And South Sudan's rebel leader says many issues still need to be resolved before a final peace deal is reached.
It's not a single issue that brings about peace. There are multiple issues. The mandate for the government is not only at the national level, it goes down up to local government. We've got to resolve those issues.
That's former South Sudan Vice President and rebel leader Riek Machar. The WFP says the worst is not over for flood-stricken Malawi, and Uganda remains a regional hub for poachers and smugglers. Those stories plus mark all my sports and our listener of the day, and Black History Month are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Burundian opposition leader has called on President Pierre Nkurunziza to take advantage of all the privileges guaranteed him under the Constitution if he leaves power peacefully and not try to change the Constitution to seek a third term. Agathon Rwasa, leader of the former Burundian Rebel National Liberation Front, the FNL, and now head of the largest opposition, says it would be unwise if security forces decided to use violence against citizens who might want to protest any decision by the president to change the Constitution. President Nkurunziza's deputy spokesman told VOA recently that the president has not said he will seek re-election, but Rwasa said Mr. Nkurunziza is simply trying to distract the attention of Burundians.
Personally, I don't appreciate the fact that he's intended to run for a third term, because this should mean a violation of the Constitution and the peace agreement signed in Arusha in 2000. Nevertheless, I think if he could be wise, he could consider the position where he is today, and also remember that he has got already guarantees through the Constitution and the Accord of Arusha, because it is stated in that Constitution that once the president's staff, he becomes a senator for all his life. And he keeps his privileges as an ancient head of state. So I don't know why he's trying to cling on that power.
I spoke with the president's spokesperson, a deputy spokesperson, Mr. Javert, and he said that President Nkurunziza is not trying to change constitution. He's only trying to make sure that Burundi's constitution is in line with other countries in the East African community.
Maybe what the spokesperson could say can only be a kind of maneuver to distract, because the attempt to change the constitution was dealt by all the political class, the civil society activists in December 2013. So he was trying to suppress some articles which could easily give him the chance to run for a third term.
Recently, we have seen protests in Burkina Faso where President Blaise Compaoré was trying to maneuver with a constitution. We also saw protests in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Suppose President Pierre Nkurunziza decides to, let's say, he wants to run for another term. Are we likely to see protests or what?
Personally, I think we cannot preach demonstration already. I think once he declares that he's running, it will depend upon the situation that will prevail at that time. But I would rather invite Mr. the President to not try to challenge his citizens if there are some who are threatening to demonstrate. So I think it would be wiser for him just to consider all the advantages he has got with regard to the Constitution and the peace agreement Because if we fail to respect the Constitution and other laws, then what we will be trying to drag for this country.
Agathon Rwasa is the leader of the former Burundian Rebel National Liberation Front and now head of the largest opposition. He was speaking with me from Bujumbura. Former South Sudan Vice President and now Rebel leader Riek Machar says many issues still need to be resolved before a final peace deal is reached. Mr. Machar spoke with John Tanza of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program.
What we have signed are areas of agreement on the establishment of the transitional government of national unity. But there are many outstanding issues. First, the leadership of the transitional government. This is not yet determined. The government wants a structure which is headed by a president and two vice presidents that are equal in status. The proposal which was given by IGAD is president, first vice president, and vice president. So we are a long way from signing a comprehensive peace agreement.
Let me take you back to the IGAD proposal about the structure of the transitional government. They're saying there will be the president, first vice president, and then vice president. Which position is proposed for the SPLM in opposition?
The position they propose is first vice president for the SPLM and SPLA.
And is that what your party is happy with?
Not necessarily, no. Not necessarily. It's not a single issue that brings about peace. There are multiple issues. The mandate for the government is not only at the national level. It goes down up to local government. We've got to resolve those issues. The security arrangements are very important. Federalism as the system of governance that we want to introduce in the country is very, very crucial. Handling issues of accountability, reconciliation are very important issues. You don't take them as single issues.
Yes. And with all these issues that you are listing, is there any reason for South Sudanese to be happy at this point that both of you are about to reach an end to this conflict?
We should all keep the optimism because it's important to be optimistic. On our side, we are committed to bringing about the peaceful settlement. Our people have suffered. There's so much displacement internally. We even have refugees in the UN camps in South Sudan, in six states. We have a lot of refugees that have fled and are in the neighboring countries from Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Sudan.
That's former South Sudan Vice President and Rebel leader Riek Machar. He spoke with John Tanza of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program. The Kenyan government has launched its first ever diaspora policy to encourage diaspora investment, keep track of Kenyans abroad, and involve them in the country's development. But as Hilary Hula reports for VOA from Nairobi, what members of the diaspora think about the policy is another story.
When Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta announced the creation of a new national policy aimed at managing the country's diaspora, millions of Kenyans around the world sat up and took notice. Like many African countries, Kenya's diaspora is extensive. An estimated 3 million Kenyans live abroad. And like many African economies, Kenya's has long been subsidized by their remittances. These amounted to around $1.3 billion last year, according to the Central Bank of Kenya. African governments rarely make a point of engaging their diasporas directly. But as Mr. Kenyatta said at the policy's launch in January, Kenyans abroad have the potential to contribute to the country's development.
Given the abundance of skilled, knowledgeable, and patriotic Kenyans outside our borders, it is now a matter of the highest priority to integrate the diaspora into our national development agenda.
But Kenyans living in the diaspora have mixed feelings about the new policy. Comfort Mwangi runs the Confederation of Kenya Diaspora Organizations from Jacksonville in the southern U.S. state of Florida. She says many Kenyans abroad have felt marginalized by the Kenyan government, including during Mr. Kenyatta's recent visit to the United States.
The president talked to us as a group, as a diaspora, and you know he told us one or two things. But when it came to serious matters, he had a meeting with Americans our age and gave them opportunities. So we need to be treated the same.
Benson Kakui, who lives in Dallas, in the southwestern U.S. state of Texas, agrees that the policy is a step in the right direction. He welcomes its focus on investment opportunities, saying many Kenyans face difficulties investing back home. But the policy also involves keeping track of Kenyans abroad and keeping a database of their details. This, says Kakui, has some people worried. When it comes to promoting Kenya's interests abroad, another part of the policy, many in the diaspora say they're glad to help. John Gachago in Gainesville, Florida, says he already does his part to boost Kenyan tourism.
When my neighbor comes and talks to me about, hey, I hear Kenya's a great place, you've got great coffee, I say, yeah, you've got to go visit. You've got to go on a safari. You've got to go try out coffee. I absolutely would do that, even without being paid for it. I love my country that much.
But if the Kenyan government sees the diaspora simply as a giant pool of free cash, they're wrong, says Mwangi. The money sent home may be a sign of love, but it's also a sign of the government's own failure to provide for its people, she says. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
Today's Wednesday, February 4th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 and a half minutes past the hour. The World Food Program says it is scaling up its humanitarian operations in Malawi, where more than 600,000 people are suffering from the worst flooding to hit that country in 15 years. As Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, the flooding has killed more than 200 people.
The annual flooding in Malawi is the worst in many years. The World Food Program warns the situation is likely to worsen as Malawi's rainy season does not peak until mid-February and heavy rains are forecast to continue. Aid agencies have been trying to help the more than 600,000 people affected by the flooding since Malawi's president declared 15 of the country's 28 districts a disaster. WFP has sent food to about 230,000 people in seven districts, but finds this is not enough and says it aims to reach an additional 160,000 people. WFP spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers tells VOA many people living in the worst flood-affected places and in remote areas are extremely difficult to reach.
Roads, bridges are damaged or washed away. Some flooded areas remain cut off from markets and food supplies. WFP has one helicopter which arrived in the country on the 23rd of January to support delivery of food and also to transport humanitarian relief cargo.
Beer says most of the 260,000 people rendered homeless by flooding are living in camps, while others are staying in public buildings, schools, or with host families. She says sanitation and hygiene are huge problems, giving rise to many health concerns.
We can see already cases of scabies among the population, and also increased cases of malaria and diarrhea. As the assessment mission and the monitoring improve, we can see more and more cases of malnutrition in camps. And those malnutrition cases are expected to rise in the near future.
WFP worries about the long-term consequences. The soil is saturated, crops are damaged, and livestock have been washed away. Last year, Malawi enjoyed a bumper maize crop, but the outlook for this year is bleak. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The South African government says, contrary to reports, it will not be deporting Zimbabweans who did not reapply for the special dispensation permits allocated for those wishing to extend their legal stay in the country. The spokesman of the South African Home Affairs Department, Mailobi Shweti, says they are in the process of establishing why Zimbabweans did not apply.
We are still going to tally up and try to find out what happened to most of the people. But what we do know is that a good number of them have moved from the ZSP to ordinary work permits. It's important to understand what the ZSP is. ZSP was done in 2010 for people who were in the country illegally, and it was done to try to regularize their stay. It wasn't the complete sum of Zimbabwean foreign nationals in South Africa, and it doesn't represent all Zimbabwean nationals in South Africa. It was specifically for those people who were in the country illegally. So some of those people may have moved from the ZSP to an ordinary work permit. I have spoken to a number of people who have done that. To the extent that deportations will happen, they will happen if anybody's undocumented, whether they're Zimbabwean or American. It's not an intention to target Zimbabwean nationals. Everybody should be documented, and that applies in America and Europe too.
How will you be tallying to find out if some people have moved
on?
We
have the department took details of those people who had received the old special dispensation. They took details of those people. So we intend to do a survey to see what happened to them.
And looking at the new ZSP process, there are some who are already receiving their permits who reapplied. May you explain how exactly someone will regularize their stay in anticipation of the permit's expiration?
The same way it applies for anybody else. You apply for a certain work permit. When you apply for that work permit, it's clarified to you what you need to do. And in many of those cases, you apply from the country of origin. You are adjudicated, and then you are given a response by the department.
So you're saying that for the Zimbabweans, even if they are under the ZSP, they will have to follow the similar law like anyone else?
Well, for the most part, we try to apply our law as equally as possible. What we expect of other foreign nationals is expect of the rest. We try to apply ourselves equally as possible.
South African Home Affairs spokesman Mailomi Tshweti was speaking with Tatenda Gombo of VOA's Zimbabwe service. In Uganda, the recent seizure of ivory and a stash of pangolin skins at Entebbe International Airport has prompted questions on what authorities are doing to combat poaching and the illegal wildlife trade. Elizabeth Pollard reports from Kampala on how the Uganda Wildlife Authority is attempting to resolve the problem.
On January 25th, more than 700 kilograms of ivory and 2 tons of pangolin skins were discovered at Entebbe International Airport. The Ugandan Wildlife Authority is investigating where these items came from. Although Uganda has made headway in removing poachers from its own national parks, regional insecurity and porous borders mean that illegal goods can be easily moved through the country and sent abroad to Europe and Asia. Ongoing conflict in the DRC and South Sudan mean that the trade of illegal wildlife is often used to help fund militias and wars. UWA manager Jossie Muhengi explains.
I would not want to implicate our neighboring countries, but last year, our veterinary unit carried out DNA tests on some of our wildlife species, particularly ivory. They discovered some of it had come from Ruaha. Ruaha is a national park in southern Tanzania. Then other samples showed it had come from eastern DRC.
Although it will take time for the most recent shipment to be traced, the UWA has been working with agencies in Uganda and neighboring countries, creating interstate partnerships with rangers in South Sudan and the DRC. This partnership allows them to go on joint patrols and combine strategy meetings in border regions. But Muhengi says it's Uganda's weak laws and punishments for poachers that make it so attractive for those transiting poached goods.
We have been having weak laws and the judiciary which had not fully appreciated the importance of wildlife. But now, I think there is a proposed amendment of Wildlife Act, I think it's at cabinet level, trying to say that whoever has been convicted of killing an animal, the fine should be equivalent to the value of the animal.
The cabinet in Uganda has approved the proposed amendments for the act, and with Parliament reconvening this month, there is a chance it could be pushed through this year. But for now, the lax laws and fines faced by the poachers makes Uganda an attractive option for wildlife smugglers. Elizabeth Bola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsor here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we focus on the Orange Africa Cup of Nations in Equatorial Guinea. Sichan Rajendra Prasad of Mauritius has been sanctioned for the manner in which he handled the quarterfinal tie between Equatorial Guinea and Tunisia last Saturday, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, revealed in Bata on Tuesday. According to the CAF referees committee, Rajendra Prasad handled the match poorly, failing to calm and properly control the players. Consequently, he will not play any further role at the Nations Cup. He has been suspended for 6 months and delisted from the CAF Elite Referees Panel. Staying in Bata, after considering all relevant information, the CAF Disciplinary Board has come down hard on the Tunisia Football Federation for the violent conduct of their players and the serious allegations made in letters from the Tunisia Football Federation President Wadi Jari. At the end of the Equatorial Guinea-Tunisia quarterfinals, which the hosts won 2-1, Tunisian players insulted and tried to physically assault the match referee. Their vandalism included breaking a door in the locker room area and damaging a fridge. Tunisia Football Federation head Wadi Jari wrote to CAF alleging that they are biased against Tunisia and lack sporting ethics. CAF has asked Equatorial Guinea to submit the estimate cost for the repairs to damages caused by the Tunisian players. CAF will forward them to Tunisia and make sure that they cover the costs of the repair. The Tunisia Federation has also been fined $50,000 for the violent conduct of their players. CAF has given Tunisia until midnight tomorrow Thursday to submit a letter apologizing for the insinuation that the continental body is biased against them and lack decorum. Alternatively, Tunisia should provide irrefutable evidence to back their claim. CAF has indicated that failure to receive a formal response from Tunisia may lead to their national team being excluded from the 2017 Nations Cup. Meanwhile, the CAF disciplinary jury has fined Equatorial Guinea $5,000 for the pitch invasion and aggressive conduct by some of the Equatorial Guinea fans at the end of the quarterfinals between Equatorial Guinea and Tunisia. CAF reminds Equatorial Guinea of their responsibility as hosts to provide the required security for the smooth running of the remaining fixtures at the tournament. Finally, on a happier note, the Democratic Republic of Congo play Ivory Coast in the first semi-final in Bata today, Wednesday. And that's it for the African Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 4th. On this day, 1913, civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks was born in Tuskegee, Alabama. In 1955, Parks was on her way home from work when she boarded a public bus and sat in one of the seats reserved for blacks. But when all the seats were filled, the bus driver ordered her to give up her seat to a white man. Rosa Parks refused, and because of that, she was arrested and jailed. Blacks in Montgomery, Alabama, decided not to ride public buses until they were treated equally. This became known as the Montgomery Bus Boycott and the beginning of the civil rights movement in the United States. On February 4, 2013, the U.S. Postal Service issued a Rosa Parks Forever stamp honoring the civil rights activist on what would have been her 100th birthday. Also on this day in 1986, the U.S. Postal Service issued a commemorative stamp in honor of Sojourner Truth, the first African-American woman to become famous for speaking out against slavery. On this day in Black history, in 1997, a civil jury in Santa Monica, California, found O.J. Simpson guilty for the deaths of both his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman. Simpson had originally been acquitted in 1995. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 4th. Congratulations to Nkwin Rabos Ankia of Mbingo Baptist Hospital in Bamenda, Cameroon, and Ambrose Agio of Makurdi in Benin State, Nigeria. You are the winners of our February 3rd question, who started Black History Month? The answer, Dr. Carter G. Wilson. Now here is our question for today, February 4th. Who was the first black man to play in the white baseball major league? Once again, who was the first black man to play in the white baseball major league? Send your answers to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your answer. Remember to include your mailing address. And that's it for this Wednesday, February 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, for the sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte saying, have a lovely day.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.